Welcome to this special highlights program of a satellite CME symposium presented during the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meetings in Washington recently, focusing on the management of ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. To follow up on some of the discussion during these two CME meetings, I met with two faculty members to discuss some of the key topics. To begin, I chatted with Dr. Jonathan Lederman, and he started our conversation out by commenting on some of the unique biologic aspects of ovarian cancer that are currently driving the use of novel agents, particularly PARP inhibitors.
One of the many interesting things about ovarian cancer is the sensitivity of the disease to platinum-based chemotherapy. And what's a little unusual about ovarian cancer is that one can use platinum often time and time again during that period of we call platinum sensitivity where progression occurs beyond a six-month interval. So there's something fundamental about the tumor that makes it sensitive to platinum-based drugs. And of course, the platinum-based drugs cause DNA cross-linking and damage to DNA that has to be repaired. And it's this impairment of the repair process that I think makes ovarian cancer a relatively unique disease and one that is susceptible to PARP inhibition. Now, PARP is an important enzyme that's involved in the repair of DNA damage. And it was shown nearly 10 years ago now that patients with a BRCA mutation have intrinsic defects in the repair of their DNA damaged. So in the presence of, let's say, a drug like platinum, they often have a very marked response, which is one of the reasons why patients with a BRCA mutation often do better with chemotherapy and live longer than those that don't have a BRCA mutation. But as far as the PARP inhibitors are concerned, what's interesting about the BRCA mutation is that if you block the repair process that's dependent upon the PARP enzyme, you need to repair the damage by a process called homologous recombination repair. And it's that repair process, this important repair process, that's defective in tumors that have a BRCA mutation. So it was then hypothesized that if you have a BRCA mutation and you give a PARP inhibitor, you may actually cause inhibition of repair of DNA and therefore cell death by a process that's sometimes called synthetic lethality. So that's how all this started and how PARP inhibitors began to be tested in tumors that have a BRCA mutation. And the various studies that were done either with a PARP inhibitor such as olaparib or rucaparib on its own in patients with a BRCA mutation, or indeed the maintenance studies in patients with a BRCA mutation, both those strategies showed that patients who receive a PARP inhibitor do better. And that's how, certainly in the USA, PARP inhibitors such as olaparib and rucaparib became licensed in patients who've got recurrent ovarian cancer and a BRCA mutation as determined by a companion diagnostic test.
So I want to get into the data, of course, particularly the recent data. But just to draw this out a little bit more, can you talk a little bit about sort of the spectrum of what you'd see biologically or genomically in ovarian cancer and how it varies based on whether it's serous or not? What do you see in the tumor?
So the most common subtype of ovarian cancer is high-grade serous ovarian cancer that represents probably around about 70%. So that's what we're dealing with most often. And we know that this is a type of ovarian cancer that's very genomically heterogeneous, a lot of mutations, particularly P53 mutations. But we know also that in about 20% of those tumors, there is a BRCA mutation. Either an inherited germline BRCA mutation, which probably accounts for around about 15% of all cases of high-grade serous ovarian cancer, or a somatic BRCA mutation within the tumor. So not inherited, but developed within the tumor in about 5%. So that gives you that group, that subgroup, if you like, of 20% of patients who are particularly susceptible to treatment with a PARP inhibitor.
As long as you're bringing that up, at this point, do you think sort of globally, qualitatively, sort of looking at it, responsiveness to PARP inhibitors is around the same with somatic as opposed to germline mutations?
Yeah, the evidence we have from particularly, well, we've got evidence accumulating not only from the olaparib studies, but also the rucaparib studies, because these studies have been done in a much broader group of patients, not only germline mutated ovarian cancer, but also somatically mutated ovarian cancer, and perhaps we'll come back to later, non-BRCA mutated ovarian cancer. But the evidence seems to suggest that the effectiveness of the PARP inhibitors is equivalent whether the patient has a somatic or germline mutation.
So going beyond BRCA mutations, what other kinds of mutations are seen in ovarian cancer that seem to increase sensitivity to PARP inhibitors, and how common are they?
So the phenotype that we're after is this process called homologous recombination deficiency, this deficiency in the repair of double-strand breaks. And this is a very complex process and requires a number of genes to be active and a number of processes to interact to produce this repair pathway. The BRCA proteins are some of the most important that are responsible for this repair process. And we've already spoken about how BRCA mutations may interfere with this HRD phenomenon. But there are a number of other key proteins that we know are important, such as the RAD51 gene products or BRIP1, CHEK1, and there are others too. But these others are sometimes difficult to measure. And this is where the difficulty arises. It's not purely a genomic mutation that we're looking for. I mean, that's much clearer in the sense of BRCA, but there may be a constellation of other problems. For example, the BRCA1 gene might be methylated. So not mutated, but there may be abnormal methylation and therefore inactivation of the BRCA gene. So there are a number of different processes that can take place in the cell that give rise to this phenotype of HR deficiency, which is the marker for responsiveness to a PARP inhibitor.
Do you sort of look at it almost as a continuum with an ovarian cancer that, you know, at least at this point, there's some amount of HR in all tumors? I don't know.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And of course, we don't have a reliable test to be able to tell us which tumors are and which tumors are not HR deficient. It's estimated that actually about 50% of high-grade serous ovarian cancer may have a degree of HR deficiency. And measurement of that is, of course, what people are trying to do, to develop tests that will give you an indication as to whether this tumor has HR deficiency. So you can put to one side the mutations that I've mentioned. We know that if you have those mutations, very high chance of HR deficiency. But we see responsiveness to PARP inhibitors in patients that don't have any of those mutations. So there must be other processes there going on that give rise to this phenotype. Now, the way that's been looked at the moment, and this is still, I think, something very much in evolution, is to look at the degree of genomic scarring that exists in the tumor, because that seems to correlate with the amount of HR deficiency. So genomic scarring is often best detected by looking at a loss of heterozygosity across the genome because of the damaged segments of DNA which are not properly repaired. And that has been the basis of both the Myriad MyChoice assay test and the Foundation Medicine test to measure HR deficiency. So I think, you know, what people are moving to is a combination of genomic analyses and then these more functional analyses to try and put together a score, if you like, to say which is what the HRD score might be, which gives you a probability that the tumor will respond to a PARP inhibitor.
You said that there's responsiveness even when, quote, there's no HR deficiency. I know we'll talk later about, you know, say in the maintenance setting. I'm not sure if you call that responsiveness. Mm-hmm. But I mean, do you see partial responses to PARP monotherapy in people who have no HR?
We certainly see it in patients who do not have BRCA mutations and who do not have the clear mutations of the genes that I mentioned. So in the trial called Aerial 2, which was a single agent rucaparib study, they took patients with platinum sensitive disease because that is a group of patients more likely to respond to a PARP inhibitor. Within that group, they allowed a small number of patients with a BRCA mutation who, if you like, served as a positive control. And they then took the rest of the group of patients who were BRCA negative, and they did the scarring type assay, if you like, on that, developed a score in terms of the genomic scarring, and divided the patients up into those that are BRCA-like on the base of the scarring and those that are biomarker negative. And what that showed is that the responsiveness to rucaparib was different in the two groups, and indeed the disease control rates and progression-free survival were also different. So they believe that they have a test that will be able to differentiate in the BRCA-negative population those patients who have HRD and those that don't have HRD. And that's being tested prospectively in the Aerial 3 maintenance trial.
What is that looking at?
So that's looking at rucaparib maintenance after chemotherapy, platinum-based chemotherapy, in both patients with a BRCA mutation and also a group that don't. And what they're trying to do is to use that scarring assay as a predictive marker for benefit of rucaparib maintenance therapy in those biomarker-positive patients.
Interesting. So I want to go through carefully the data, which, you know, actually has changed since we were even at that meeting, because I think the next day they presented Solo 2, which was extremely fascinating data set. But before we do that, just one other question. You were talking about the idea of BRCA germline and other cancers. And I'll share with you that at the GU symposium a couple months ago, I had a distinguished panel of six prostate investigators. And I went down the line and I said, do you consider it standard of care to do BRCA germline testing in metastatic prostate cancer? And every single one of them said yes, to my astonishment. And every single one of them had patients who they had treated with a PARP inhibitor responded.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Are we at the sort of basket stage of BRCA germline and PARP? Like, is it reasonable that anybody who's got a cancer, even though theoretically it might not necessarily be related, with a BRCA germline should have a trial of a PARP inhibitor if they have metastatic disease and no other option?
Yeah, I think that's difficult. I mean, I think there's a grading scale. You know, we see BRCA mutations most commonly in breast and ovarian cancer. And I think the next most common tumor that's associated with germline BRCA mutations is prostate cancer. But I think when you get down to pancreatic cancer, the frequency of finding a BRCA mutation, a germline BRCA mutation in pancreatic cancer is very small. Of course, going back to the family history here is, of course, very important, because if you have family histories of cancer in your pancreatic cancer patients, you know, your index of suspicion will increase and it makes positive tests more likely. But I think we're not quite at the point where I think we can routinely test, or should routinely test, that's a cost issue, of course, that's all patients with metastatic cancer for the presence of a BRCA mutation.
So why don't we try to go through, it's even when we organized the symposium, we were trying to figure out how to have people present the data. Do you present it by the agent? Do you present it by the, you know, maintenance or monotherapy? It's a little bit tricky, again, particularly for somebody on the outside. But why don't we go through certainly the three major indicated drugs in the United States right now, and what the clinical research database is that relates to those three drugs. But before we do that, just one other drug I want to ask you about, because, you know, it's always hard to figure out when you have a class of drugs. And this is an important, I guess, general question, which is, what is the difference between these PARP inhibitors? So before you even start getting into this, in your own mind, in terms of both efficacy as well as tolerability issues, globally, how do you think about these three? And also the other one I want to bring in is veliparib, because I've kind of heard some different things about veliparib. But before you get into the data globally, how do you see the difference between, let's say, these four drugs?
Okay. I think there's probably not much daylight between olaparib, rucaparib, and niraparib in terms of their activity as PARP inhibitors. You know, no one, of course, has done direct comparisons, but broadly, we're seeing the same single agent responsiveness. We're seeing similar effects in the maintenance setting. We're seeing similar effects in the BRCA mutated population and in the non-BRCA mutated population. Those three drugs have slightly different spectra of toxicities. For example, with rucaparib, you get a little bit more liver function test abnormalities, a little bit more myelosuppression and nausea. With olaparib, anemia, fatigue, nausea are the key side effects. And with niraparib, you get more myelosuppression, particularly thrombocytopenia, which often occurs early in the treatment, and a little bit of hypertension. But, you know, all of those are manageable. And in all of the trials that have been done, a relatively small percentage of patients drop out of the studies on the basis of toxicity. They're all pretty manageable. Doses have to be modified. Drug holidays have to be sometimes given, but they're pretty manageable.
I wanted to ask you about the platelet thing before you get to the liver, because at least in the data, I don't know, I don't think I'd seen that before. It wasn't that dramatic, but it was clearly there. But for example, do you see, you know, thrombocytopenia with olaparib and rucaparib just not as often, or you just don't see it?
Well, you don't really see it with olaparib. You see it to a degree with rucaparib, but it's much less than with niraparib. And it tends to be a sort of cumulative toxicity that you see after several months. What's peculiar about the niraparib toxicity is that the thrombocytopenia often occurs early, within the first two cycles. It was very uncommon to see significant thrombocytopenia beyond cycle three, beyond the third month, in the niraparib trial. So providing you can get through that first 3 months with dose interruptions or dose modifications, then usually you can manage the platelet count for the rest of the treatment period.
So you were going to talk about veliparib.
So veliparib, first of all, I'll say is a drug that I personally have no experience of. So my information about that is from really reading the literature and talking to people who are involved in the clinical trials. But my sense is from reading those reports that the drug as a PARP inhibitor doesn't appear to be quite as active as the other three drugs. So the single agent activity or the activity with chemotherapy doesn't seem to be as pronounced as it is with those other three drugs. The drug is now in trial in a slightly different setting in combination with chemotherapy and then maintenance. That's been a difficult thing to do with the other PARP inhibitors. People have tried combining chemotherapy with olaparib and other PARP inhibitors, and it's been quite toxic. Both the chemotherapy has been difficult to handle and the PARP inhibitor. So the fact that it seems to be manageable with veliparib tells us perhaps that it's a slightly different PARP inhibitor. And I think it remains to be seen whether that trial demonstrates an added value of veliparib. But I don't see veliparib coming forward in exactly the same way that those other three are now coming forward, either as single agent therapy or as maintenance therapy.
It's interesting, though, about this issue of combining it with chemotherapy with platinums. What's the design of the study?
So the first study was a study called Study 41 with olaparib, carboplatin, and paclitaxel in the platinum sensitive.
No, I meant veliparib.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
So the design of the study with veliparib, it's a three-arm study where one of the arms contains veliparib and chemotherapy followed by veliparib maintenance. The other arm is veliparib plus chemotherapy followed not by maintenance, and the other is a control arm. So it is specifically looking at the interaction of veliparib and chemotherapy on the basis that these drugs have an effect on DNA repair, which is what we knew right at the outset, and therefore there is a scientific basis for assuming that giving a PARP inhibitor with chemotherapy will enhance the degree of cytotoxicity of the chemotherapy. So there's a rationale for it.
Do you think that part of the benefit, and we'll get into the trials though, but that part of the benefit that's been seen with the so-called maintenance studies is some way related to chemotherapy or platinum setting the tumor up for PARP inhibitors, that sort of sequence? And do you see any potential advantage of, I mean, I guess you never know, but it sort of makes sense that maybe there might be an advantage if you combine it.
Well, I think platinum-based chemotherapy is still very good at cytoreduction. So, you know, we see good responses even in the recurrent disease setting. So having debulked the tumor, if you like, with chemotherapy, the difficulty is then keeping the tumor away, stopping it from regrowing. And that's where a maintenance strategy, such as the PARP inhibitor, I think comes in. The thoughts originally were, well, maybe we should be, as with the veliparib trial, combining the chemotherapy and the PARP inhibitor and then continuing the PARP inhibitor. And that, of course, is what was done in Study 41. But that interaction with olaparib and chemotherapy, carboplatin and paclitaxel, was quite toxic. And compromises had to be made both for the chemotherapy dose and the schedule of olaparib. And actually, the trial didn't show any difference in progression-free survival during the early phase of treatment, namely during the chemotherapy phase. So I think although there are theoretical reasons why a PARP inhibitor might enhance the activity of chemotherapy, I think the strategy is increasingly use the chemotherapy, get to the point where the tumor is as small as it reasonably can be made with chemotherapy, then come in with the maintenance PARP inhibitor.
So let's try to sort out the way the three approved drugs can be integrated into practice. Why don't we start out with the most recent one? In a way, it's sort of the simplest, at least, because there's one major study. I think at least that, from my point of view, at least makes it a little bit easier to deal with. So let's start out with niraparib. Can you talk about the clinical research that's been done on the drug, the approval, and how you see it being used?
Okay. So niraparib, like the other two PARP inhibitors, was shown to have good single agent activity in, you know, small phase one, phase two studies in BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer. Study 19 was the first maintenance study with olaparib that showed activity not only in the BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer, but globally in all patients, including those that did not have a BRCA mutation. So on the basis of that, they designed a trial modeling it on study 19, namely that they would take patients with platinum-sensitive disease responding to platinum and then offer maintenance niraparib. And what they did was to divide their patients into two cohorts. So effectively, it was almost like two separate randomized trials. Group one was a group of patients with germline BRCA mutation, because that's where they knew the strongest data were from the previous data with olaparib. And then the second cohort was non-germline BRCA mutation. So really a pool of different groups of patients that we can come back to in a moment. And those patients were randomized 2-1 to niraparib or placebo post-platinum-based chemotherapy. Now, what that trial showed was that if you look at the global endpoints of those two cohorts, that in both cohorts, there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival using maintenance niraparib over placebo in both the germline BRCA mutant cohort and the non-germline BRCA mutant cohort. And that actually was the basis of their submission to the FDA on the basis that they had two cohorts, germline, non-germline BRCA mutation, and both those individual cohorts showed significant clinical benefit from niraparib. And it was actually on the basis of that that the FDA gave a global approval for niraparib as maintenance therapy in platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer. Now, if you drill down a little bit more into the non-germline BRCA mutant group, there are three subclasses, if you like, within that. There are those who have a somatic BRCA mutation. About 5% or so of all those patients will have a somatic mutation. And interestingly, the activity of niraparib in that group was virtually identical in terms of the PFS and the hazard ratio to the germline group, which just supports what we've said earlier, that these drugs are active in both germline and somatic BRCA mutations. But what they then did was to look at the Myriad assay, which gives a measure of HR deficiency, and divided this subgroup of non-germline patients into HRD positive and HRD negative groups. And what you saw was, using that assay, that niraparib was still significantly active in both the HRD positive and HRD negative group. The degree of activity as measured by the hazard ratio was diminishing, but there was still statistical significance in terms of PFS.
Another question, I'm guessing that these patients did not receive the drug on relapse. Is that true?
There was no crossover.
No crossover in the control group.
There was no crossover to control group.
And
yes.
I mean, the hazard rates are very impressive for progression-free survival. You know, in the germline group, it's 0.27. In the HRD, it's 0.38. And then the other one, it's 0.45, no germline. But what about survival? Is it too early? And what would you expect with these kinds of hazard rates? And also, what about the issue of crossover?
Okay. So I think, first of all, it is too early to know what the long-term benefits of niraparib are. And I think it's really important that we wait and we see those. What I can speak about is the longer-term survival with olaparib, because we have a much longer follow-up from the Study 19 olaparib maintenance trial. What we see there is that there is a better survival in patients on olaparib. The difficulty is that that difference does not reach statistical significance. And the reasons for that are complex. Firstly, 23% of patients in study 19 on olaparib managed to access a PARP inhibitor beyond progression, either olaparib in a different trial or they switched to rucaparib or niraparib in a different trial. And we know that crossover has a major confounding effect on overall survival differences. The second is that we know that in patients who are treated with a drug for a particular tumor and have an improvement in progression-free survival, it is sometimes difficult to show that that benefit is sustained to show a difference in overall survival, particularly if the length of survival post-progression is very long, because they have multiple lines of other treatments, trial treatments, all sorts of things. And that, again, has a sort of mitigating effect on the differences in progression-free survival. Now, when you're dealing with ovarian cancer and you're dealing with BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer, one of the characteristics is these patients live a long time. And so many of these patients will go on to have several lines of treatment beyond the olaparib treatment where you demonstrated this benefit in progression. So it was very difficult for us to show a significant improvement in overall survival. There was still a favorable hazard ratio. It was actually 0.62 for olaparib, but it was not classically statistically significant. But one other very interesting thing emerged from this long follow-up with olaparib, and of course we will need to look for that in the niraparib study. And that is that up to last year, we had actually a median of 6 years follow-up on these patients. These are patients with recurrent ovarian cancer who've had two or three prior lines of treatment. And what was interesting was that 15% of patients with a BRCA mutation were still taking olaparib 5 years after they started the trial. So we've got a cohort of patients with a BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer who are on their second or third line of chemotherapy, go on to olaparib, and who do not relapse for more than 5 years. Now, that's unprecedented in the treatment of recurrent ovarian cancer, in my view. It's a small number, but it's significant for those 15% of women who continue taking the drug 5 years and beyond without any evidence of recurrence.
It's interesting, too, just the idea of somebody taking a PARP inhibitor for 5 years is pretty interesting because, like, up to now, I mean, I guess it's because in education, you're always talking about toxicity. I mean, I guess you've seen patients just sort of get into a groove, take the drug, have no problem.
Absolutely, absolutely. So one of our longest patients on the trial, I was fortunate enough to be introduced to when I was lecturing in Melbourne last December. And she has been on the trial for 7 years.
Wow.
She had four lines of chemotherapy. She has a BRCA mutation, had four lines of chemotherapy, went on to the trial, drew olaparib. She did need a dose reduction after some months. I can't remember how many. But after that, she stabilized and she's been on the drug for 7 years. And I caught her visiting the hospital before she was just about to go on holiday for the December break. 7 years on the drug. Absolutely fantastic. Completely well.
Interesting. So when you walk through these data that you just talked about, you would think that a physician in practice who had a patient with platinum-sensitive recurrence who was responding to platinum, like most people, would want to give niraparib to that patient, period, end of sentence, no assay.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, the other thing to mention about the long-term data on olaparib, I told you that 15% of patients with a BRCA mutation were still on the drug at 5 years. 12% of patients without a BRCA mutation were also on the drug beyond 5 years. So there clearly are cohorts of BRCA positive and BRCA negative patients who really are long-term responders. Now, we don't have the data for niraparib yet. It'll be, of course, extremely important to see whether those cohorts emerge from the niraparib data. But what you say is absolutely correct. If you demonstrate platinum sensitivity, then there's every good reason to hope that both patients with a BRCA mutation and those BRCA wild-type patients will benefit from the drug, and the data suggests that, and that there may be cohorts within those of BRCA-positive and BRCA-negative who will be long-term survivors and benefit in the long term. And of course, that's without determining BRCA status. And as the license has just come through from the FDA, there is no need to have a companion diagnostic to prescribe niraparib maintenance therapy in the USA.
What about the issue of MDS risk in PARP inhibitors?
Yeah, okay. So the development of MDS and AML is actually a recognized complication of patients who have a BRCA mutation. So in the days before we ever started to use PARP inhibitors, there are clearly recorded cases of patients with a BRCA mutation who go on to develop MDS-AML and indeed second malignancies outside the more common breast and ovarian cancers.
Could I just say, I mean, I haven't heard that before. So in general, is it accepted that people with BRCA germline mutations, I mean, whether it's, you know, breast cancer or whatever, have a higher incidence of MDS?
Correct. That is correct.
Wow.
The historic literature is quite clear about that.
Huh. Fascinating.
So the important question, of course, to address with the PARP inhibitors is whether or not the incidence increases. And what we saw both in the olaparib studies and in the niraparib studies, that there was a very slight increase in MDS-AML in the patients on the PARP inhibitor. Now, it's too early to know exactly how big that difference is. It's very small. You know, we're talking about single-digit numbers of patients. And what's really important going forward is, of course, that we follow up in the clinical practice and assimilate the data that comes out from late long-term toxicity to know what the magnitude of that difference is. But it's likely to be small. We saw MDS-AML in both the control arms of the NOVA trial and niraparib trial and the study 19 trial. One of the interesting things in the olaparib study is that the cases of MDS-AML we saw occurred relatively early in the treatment. And again, with the prolonged follow-up of patients that we now have in those who remained on the drug and who remain alive, we saw no additional cases of MDS-AML. So I think it's not as big a problem as it was initially thought to be, but it does need to be monitored.
So I'm going to give you a theoretical situation. I'd like you to tell me how you would respond to it. You have a patient who's just had debulking surgery for ovarian cancer. I'll say situation one, they're BRCA germline. Situation two, they're not. They're about to get, I guess you'd say, adjuvant chemotherapy after surgery. They've got a CA2729 that's elevated that goes down when they get chemotherapy. And the patient comes to you and says, I know it's not approved, but I'm very wealthy, and I'd like you to give me niraparib. How would you respond?
So at the moment, of course, we have absolutely no data in the first-line setting. There's a very important study that should report next year called the SOLO-1 study, which is an olaparib maintenance study in patients with a BRCA mutation in the first-line setting. Now, if that study reports positive, then, of course, that will change the geography completely, and we will be much more leaning towards giving PARP inhibitors in the first-line setting. But until that happens, there are some notes of caution that I would give about using either PARP inhibitor in the first-line setting in a clearly unapproved setting. The first is that if the patient has a BRCA mutation and has a relatively early ovarian cancer, whether you draw the line at stage 2 or stage 3A, we could argue about. But the point is that some of those patients do extremely well with surgery and chemotherapy. And therefore, you know, giving long-term niraparib or olaparib off-license is, in addition to the cost issue, just adding in potential toxicity without knowing whether you're giving anything that's beneficial. And the question is, how long do you go on for? In the recurrent setting, where you know that nearly 100% of patients will recur, you know, you go on till they relapse, so long as they've not got toxicity. But we know that there are about 25% of long-term survivors first line. How long are you going to go on for? The clinical trials, the SOLO-1 clinical trial, gives the drug for 2 years and then stops. And you could argue why. We don't know, but they had to draw a line somewhere. If, on the other hand, the patient has a stage 3 or 4 disease, where clearly the prognosis is less good, let's say particularly stage 4, then, you know, there's an argument that the patient may put forward, if cost is not an issue, that I'd rather have my olaparib now than, you know, later down the line. I think all you can say in that setting is that there are no data, and that really the most secure data are giving the drug at first relapse after they've had platinum-based chemotherapy again.
Okay, so we've been through niraparib, which I'm not going to say is easy, but at least it's sort of straightforward. But now we start getting into olaparib. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can trace the clinical research database there, how it was fitting into practice until recently at the SGO meeting, where we saw new data in the maintenance setting in the SOLO2 trial.
Yeah. So the situation in the US has been different from the rest of the world insofar as the license for olaparib is in patients who've had 3 or more lines of chemotherapy and carry a germline BRCA mutation. And that's as a single agent on the basis that these patients are not likely to do very well with chemotherapy. There was an unmet need. And on the basis of a study, a phase 2 study actually, that looked at the cohort of women with ovarian cancer, active ovarian cancer, treated with olaparib, the FDA gave approval for single agent olaparib, where, you know, we know that the benefit in terms of disease control rate is a sort of median of about 7 months. So that was the case in the US. The rest of the world had a different license. It was not based on those data. It was based on the Study 19 maintenance trial, and it was based on the group of women who had a BRCA mutation and then had olaparib. The FDA, for all sorts of rather complicated reasons, decided not to grant approval for maintenance on Study 19 and asked the company to provide more data in a randomized phase 3 trial confined to patients who had a BRCA mutation. And that was the basis of the SOLO2 trial that was presented at the SGO. That incidentally used a different formulation of olaparib, not the capsule formulation, which is not terribly palatable for patients. It requires them to take 8 capsules twice a day, so 16 capsules a day, whereas the tablet formulation of 300 milligrams twice daily, just 4 tablets, so much easier for patients to manage. So the design of the trial was virtually identical to the Study 19, except it only included patients with a BRCA mutation. It did not include BRCA wild-type patients. And those data presented at the SGO showed a highly significant improvement in progression-free survival when olaparib was given compared to placebo. It showed the tolerability that we were anticipating, very similar spectrum of side effects to the capsules, relatively low dropout rate due to toxicity. And this drug has been granted fast-track approval pathway by the FDA.
So I know you're not supposed to do indirect comparisons, but it is interesting that if you look at the SOLO2 trial, as I read it here, the hazard rate for PFS was 0.30, right?
You know, yes.
Pretty impressive, 70% reduction. But it's interesting, in the niraparib study, the hazard rate for BRCA mutation was 0.27, almost identical.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's very little to choose between the two drugs. 0.27, I should just add, was in the germline BRCA cohort.
Isn't that what it was here with SOLO2 also?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right. Exactly, that's what I was saying, was the same, right.
Yes, in the same groups of patients. So
right.
I think there's little to choose between the two drugs in terms of efficacy.
You know, there's always going to be regulatory issues. And I guess also there's the issue of using one PARP inhibitor after receiving another. Is there any evidence that that should be considered?
Yeah, so at the moment, we really don't have the data, but it's important those trials are done, that we look at rechallenging with a PARP inhibitor, possibly a different PARP inhibitor, after a patient has failed on one PARP inhibitor. I think what one would normally do is to intersperse with chemotherapy rather than just immediately shift to a PARP inhibitor, but it partly depends on the context in which that's being tested.
And again, I don't know exactly what the, you know, sort of regulatory reimbursement issues are going to be, but I guess, you know, in terms of which one you would give, and we'll get to rucaparib in a second, but just in terms of this maintenance situation, if olaparib then becomes approved in platinum-sensitive BRCA germline, theoretically, you'd have the choice of niraparib or olaparib in a BRCA germline patient, correct?
Correct.
Coin flip?
Well, I think that's a very difficult one for physicians to choose. There may be a price question to look at. There is this different spectrum of toxicity between the two drugs, but, you know, both are broadly manageable. It's difficult to know how the two companies are going to market their two drugs in that setting. Of course, what there is at the moment is much longer follow-up with the olaparib maintenance drug. And that, of course, we don't know what's going to happen with niraparib in the longer term. And that may be something that the company would play to in terms of trying to promote the use of olaparib in that germline positive population.
Well, again, also just thinking about the way things are right now, too, I guess if you had a patient who was platinum refractory, who'd gotten several lines of chemo, who was germline positive, the classic indication for olaparib, you couldn't really give niraparib to a patient like that, at least from a regulatory perspective.
No, you couldn't. In that situation where you've not got at least a partial response to the chemotherapy, which is where the label is, partial response to platinum-based chemotherapy, then maintenance PARP inhibitor. But in the setting where you've got bulky disease, platinum resistance, then you rely on the label of olaparib, the current FDA label for olaparib, or the current FDA label for rucaparib.
And I was going to get to that because that's the third layer I want to kind of try to add in here. So let's talk about rucaparib, the data on that, the approval there, and again, how that's going to fit into this whole thing with the three of them.
Yes. So, you know, at the moment, we don't have the maintenance data for rucaparib. That will come out in the Aerial 3 trial, which we hope will be ready later this year. So putting the maintenance question to one side, where the label is at the moment in the USA is for patients who've had two or more lines of chemotherapy, who have a BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer, and that includes somatic or germline, and they are then suitable for rucaparib therapy. So the data for rucaparib are broadly similar to the data for olaparib in that setting. One has to remember that the license for olaparib in the US is for three or more lines, whereas the license for rucaparib is two or more prior lines of chemotherapy.
Could I just clarify, do those lines include adjuvant chemotherapy?
Yeah, so it would include the first line of platinum, correct, yes. So if you have a group of patients who've had only two prior lines, you know, the expectation is that the response rate, the duration of the response rate is probably going to be longer than it is if you've had three prior lines. So you have to be very careful if you try to make comparisons between the olaparib and rucaparib data in terms of the USA license. And again, I think there's very little to choose between the two in terms of activity, very slight differences in spectra of toxicity, but it's not very great.
But you can give rucaparib after three lines of chemo, correct?
Oh, you can. You can.
So,
yes.
Again, coin flip in that situation between olaparib and rucaparib.
Well, I think it is a bit of a flip coin. At the moment, as we speak today, of course, the olaparib license in the USA is for the capsules, which are 16 capsules a day. Whereas the rucaparib license is 600 milligrams twice daily, which are four a day. So there may be a question of it being more palatable for patients to have rucaparib than olaparib on that basis alone.
I next met with faculty member Dr. Bradley Monk. And to begin, he picked up on a topic discussed by Dr. Letterman, the current management of recurrent ovarian cancer.
So as you know, the most common relapsed ovarian cancer patient is a patient that's called platinum-sensitive relapse. That's what happens generally. And in my mind, bevacizumab is a second-line drug. It's approved in basically every second-line scenario, platinum-resistant, platinum-sensitive, with five chemotherapy backbones. And probably every patient needs bevacizumab in that setting, or maybe even frontline, but needs bevacizumab. So I prefer to cross through that window in that platinum-sensitive relapse patient. Now, the complicated factor is that in platinum-sensitive relapse, based on OCEANS and 213, that includes a maintenance phase. And I wouldn't personally ever abandon bevacizumab maintenance in favor of PARP maintenance, even in a BRCA germline mutated patient. So I look at PARP as a third line drug and Bev is a second line drug. And I think it's just that simple.
Obviously, in order to, I guess, to come to that conclusion, you feel like the therapeutic benefit of maintenance Bev or Bev plus maintenance is greater than with PARP inhibitors. But I mean, in the niraparib trial, the hazard rate was 0.27 for the BRCA germline or whatever, you know, it was under 3 for the BRCA germline, which you said you still wouldn't use. And isn't that a higher hazard rate than what you see by adding Bev?
I do not look at it that way at all. See, you're comparing one treatment versus the other. I am looking about the sequencing of events or the agents. I'm looking about which agent to use first. That patient that you just described, that germline BRCA patient, she's going to get both drugs. It's only a matter of when. And so that's the role of molecular testing, right? So molecular testing can either be germline, somatic, and somatic can either be BRCA or HRD. And it's the molecular signature that allows me to sequence the agents. And that's the most important point that we can make. They're going to get both drugs. It's not one or, it's one and it's only a matter of when. And when is informed by the molecular signature.
Well, how does the molecular signature change what you do?
Well, if she is HRD negative, I may delay PARP for subsequent lines of therapy. So I may use PARP fourth or fifth line. Okay. At the same time, if she is BRCA positive, I would use PARP third line. And what happens is that people get mired into these indications. The indications for olaparib, rucaparib, and niraparib are all different. But let's face it, the indications are so broad that now with niraparib's approval, most patients are going to be able to get PARP in some scenario. So it's only a matter of sequencing.
Just to clarify, though, again, you know, we, of course, are always in the habit of asking investigators what they do. A lot of times we do them by surveys. It's just that this has only been, like, whatever, a couple weeks now. You're one of the first people I've even talked to.
Since March 27th, yep, niraparib.
But in any event, I'm really trying to speculate, and I'd like you to speculate. What do you think we're going to find when we go out and ask 20 ovarian cancer investigators, what they're doing? Do you think they're going to do what you just said, or do you think they're going to bring PARP in and drop the Bev and, let's say, platinum sensitive?
It's a great question. And, you know, it's challenging to predict what people are going to do, but I suspect that many people are not going to agree with me. I think that we're riding a wave of enthusiasm. You just said that in the NOVA trial in the BRCA mutated group, the hazard ratio is 0.27. The medians go from 5.5 to 21 months. They're so excited about that.
And incidentally, that was the, I can't remember which one was 0.27, which one was 0.3, but it was almost the identical hazard rate with Solo 2 with olaparib in BRCA germline.
That's right. Solo 2 is 0.3. But we have to be more controlled, take the emotion out of it. Let's face it, GOG-213 has a 5-month improvement survival advantage. It's the only one.
You're talking about with Bev?
Yeah, with Bev. So if you want to be data-driven.
5 months.
Yeah, 5 months of overall survival.
And what's the hazard rate?
The hazard ratio is not great. I don't have it in my mind. It's like 8.4 or something. But still, the microenvironment has changed because these are highly sensitive patients. They get lots of subsequent therapy, but they live longer. These patients need Bev. And remember, this is the key point also, is that if you delay the use of bevacizumab to the end, the risk of GI perforation is higher. The risk of GI perforation doesn't even appear in the label for platinum-sensitive relapsed ovarian cancer with bevacizumab because the risk is trivial, if not non-existent. So use Bev early. It's extremely well tolerated. It's better tolerated than PARP, hands down for sure. And use it, get through it. And that doesn't mean that it's better than PARP. It just means it needs to be used. And then we'll use PARP next. It's that simple. But don't do one versus the other because these patients are going to get 5, 6, 7 lines of therapy and live for years.
So you're thinking more long-term chronic maintenance kind of strategy.
Listen, ovarian cancer is managed. It's not cured. And I'm trying to manage it. If you look at this as really treatment, where it's one and done, it's not the way it works. I'm looking at the trajectory and the long-term outcome.
What about platinum-resistant disease in people who haven't had Bev? Bev first, right?
Yeah, it's a no-brainer, right? So the activity of PARP inhibitors is informed by three things. molecular signature, number of lines of therapy, and platinum sensitivity. So you just said, oh, how about platinum resistance? So that right there, that's one of those three things. You tick that box. PARP is going to work poorly for that. And Bev works very well. It, you know, more than doubles the hazard ratio. It improves symptoms. It's the only patient-reported outcome result that is favorable. So Bev is an ideal drug. And again, for that second-line patient. So if you get a platinum-resistant relapse second line, use Bev. If you get a platinum-sensitive relapse, use Bev. And then ultimately, PARPs are for subsequent lines of therapy, whether it be third, fourth, fifth, or beyond.
What do you think about the possible strategy of using chemotherapy and adding just Bev in during the chemo, and then for maintenance using a PARP inhibitor?
I don't like it. I think that you want to get all of the benefit out of Bev you can. And remember, the response rate in GOG 213 is almost 80%. So these patients are responding, they're developing cumulative chemotherapy-related toxicities. It's an ideal scenario to transition now into the maintenance phase of bevacizumab, which is very well tolerated. And so let's put some numbers on it. So let's say you have a BRCA-mutated patient. She's going to get frontline surgery and treatment, and she's going to recur at about 2 years, okay? So then she's going to get chemotherapy and Bev maintenance, and she's going to go another year and a half. So you got 6 months of frontline, 2 months of chemotherapy, and then another year and a half. So you're already at 4 years, and you've only had two lines of therapy. Then you're going to give her platinum again, and she's going to get to 4.5 years. And then she's going to get PARP, and then she's going to be to 6 years, and she's only had four lines of therapy. So that's a typical scenario. Four lines of therapy, 6 years, she has little or no cumulative toxicity, and by then we'll have immunotherapy approved. And then she'll get that, and then this patient's going to live 10 years unless you over-treat her, okay? The chemotherapy is every bit maybe more toxic than the cancer. The second thing is, if you look at the niraparib label carefully, this distinction between maintenance and treatment is very complicated. So niraparib is approved as maintenance, and olaparib and rucaparib are as treatment. You know, what does that really mean? And in the niraparib label, it says that you have to start it within 8 weeks of platinum. It actually says that. So it says niraparib should be started within 8 weeks of the last dose of platinum. And so how serious are we about that statement? Because it's not in the indication. It's under the usage component of the package insert, product information. So our payer's going to say, oh, we're sorry. You know, that's 57 days. You know, you missed it by one day.
You think people really do that?
I don't know. It's brand new.
Hmm.
But this distinction between maintenance and treatment is something that we need to have more discussion about.
I agree. And actually, I was mentioning at the meeting the concept of, you know, people don't really call tamoxifen maintenance. Although, you know, it is given for a long period of time, but it's viewed more as a monotherapy. But I guess Jonathan brought up this concept of, you know, trying to long-term maintain the state induced by chemotherapy. And that makes sense to me also.
That's right. That's a great analogy. But think about that. In the niraparib label, it now has 8 weeks. So is that now the threshold? 57 versus 56 days?
Where are we today in terms of germline and somatic testing, particularly as it relates to treatment of ovarian cancer?
I think we all understand that every epithelial ovarian cancer patient should have germline BRCA testing based on ASCO, NCCN, and SGO guidelines. But I think that we need to really begin to talk about panel testing, not just germline BRCA, but other germline mutations. And people say, well, what do you do, Brad, if you find them? Well, as you know, there are now three NCCN guidelines for other BRCA-like germline mutations, BRIP1, RAD51C, and RAD51D. And then certainly there's the Lynch syndrome genes too, which there are NCCN guidelines of what to do when mutations are found.
Is that enough to use a PARP inhibitor, for example? Do you approach them from the point of view of PARP inhibitors? I mean, not talking about genetic counseling, but just the use of PARP inhibitors. Do you treat them like BRCA germline?
So, right, there are two reasons. One is for the kindred. The second is for predictive biomarkers, and the answer is yes. BRIP1, RAD51C, and RAD51D, yes.
Hmm.
So teach that. Help the world begin to expand their practice in germline testing using a panel in all ovarian cancer patients.
Okay, so how about if I say, given the fact that you have niraparib available, even if, you know, you don't need any testing for, and you still see benefit. How about if I say, putting aside the sort of genetic counseling issues, which may or may not be important, from a therapeutic point of view, how about if I say from a practical point of view, in terms of therapy, you don't really need BRCA testing?
Well, you do, right? Because we're coming full circle here. Testing for HRD and testing for germline BRCA helps inform the sequence of the medications.
So it's in terms of potential benefit then, not whether...
Yes.
Yeah, so you still think it's important in terms of a predictor of benefit. Yeah, that makes sense.
Because you counsel your patient, and you've practiced oncology, and everyone listening does, and then you do too. So the patient wants to know what's the chance it's going to work.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's a good point.
And you can't say, oh, I don't know, I didn't look at the genetics of your tumor. That's not a good answer. The answer is, I looked at the genetics of your tumor, and based on the genetics, the number of lines of therapy, and the platinum sensitivity, the response rate is about this, and it's rather precise.
All right, well, I have another devil's advocate question for you. How about, again, thinking from primarily a therapeutic point of view, how about if I say maybe the first thing that should be done, and I think this was actually presented by somebody at the SGO meeting because somebody told me about it. How about if we say what you really ought to do is some kind of NGS testing on the tumor, and then if they've got BRCA or something else, if you want, you can go back and figure out whether it's germline, but at least you'll get all the somatic. And, you know, from sort of a clinical flow point of view, it makes sense to look at the tumor first.
Yeah, I love that idea. And that makes sense, except we have some of these other germline mutations. So that's fine. But remember, it's not just about BRCA. It's about BRIP1, RAD51C, RAD51D, Lynch, and so on. So if we have the bioinformatics to do that, I think that's fine. Because all, you know, germline mutations, they're present in the tumor.
Right.
And if you use the tumor as a triage, it's fine.
I want to kind of turn to the one that you were more involved with, which dealt with a bunch of issues. And we began talking about ovarian cancer, but we were actually talking about, you know, sort of non-PARP issues. And you began the meeting by talking about reviewing some of the data related to treatment of advanced ovarian cancer. Particularly, you went through some of the stuff you were referring to earlier related to bevacizumab. Could you just go back and talk a little bit about some of the key data sets that came out in the last few years related to bevacizumab, and sort of, you know, you were talking about it before, the way that has led you to integrate the drug into your own practice.
Right. So ovarian cancer is probably the most active drug for bevacizumab. The editorial by Stan Kay in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, when we presented our single agent phase 2 data, Bob Berger, the editorial was called Bevacizumab, Its Finest Hour. So bevacizumab is generally not considered to be active as a single agent in the other tumors that it's labeled in, such as colorectal cancer and lung, but it is active as a single agent. And so it kind of speaks to the biology that ovarian cancer is very angiogenesis driven, and really ascites is angiogenesis out of control. So around the world, it's labeled as a frontline drug. It's not labeled as a frontline drug, again, with chemotherapy and maintenance in the United States. But in the United States, it's labeled as mostly a second-line drug in platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer with 3 chemotherapy options, topotecan, paclitaxel, and pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And it's labeled with 2 other chemotherapy options in platinum-sensitive relapse, carboplatin paclitaxel and carboplatin gemcitabine. And in the sensitive setting, because the response rates are almost as high as frontline, there's a maintenance component as well. So 5 chemotherapy options, it's a second line drug. And although the frontline indication is not here, some people still use it, but rarely.
What about you? I hear people talking about the high risk situation.
In patients frontline that have large volumes of residual disease or stage 4, both the 2 pivotal trials, GOG-218 and ICON-7, there was an 8-month survival advantage. It wasn't the primary endpoint, but it's provocative. And I love that idea, quite frankly. But I have trouble getting it reimbursed because it's off-label.
And, you know, globally, do you sort of view it as, you know, risk reduction thing in general, that whatever stage you're going to use it, there's going to be some added benefit, and, you know, we just don't have the research to prove it up front?
Well, I think there's no question that there is added benefit. The question is the financial toxicity. So the way drugs are reimbursed in this country is obviously different than other countries. But in let's say, France and Germany, to highly developed countries, Bev is almost always used frontline based on their reimbursement structure. But that's not the way it is here. So it's definitely rational. There is a benefit, and the benefit's probably exaggerated based on the bulk of the disease.
So there are two other things that we chatted about that I want to just sort of get back into. One is neoadjuvant therapy. The other is IP, intraperitoneal therapy. Seems like these are issues that have been out there for a long time. Where are we today with them?
So neoadjuvant chemotherapy is a strategy to begin primary advanced ovarian cancer treatment with chemotherapy rather than surgery when the surgery would not result in a complete resection or R0. And that's common. Frequently, you can figure that out on a CAT scan. If you want to do a laparoscopy to assess the extent of disease, fine. But about half of patients with advanced, newly diagnosed ovarian cancer begin with chemotherapy and have the surgery between the third and the fourth cycle. So it's common. Intraperitoneal chemotherapy, I think, is dead for now. There are a small group of people that think that the old data still is relevant. The old data is very provocative. But the new data that has a better control arm invalidates the earlier data because the earlier data didn't have the right control arm. But when the right control arm is used, which is dose-dense weekly paclitaxel and every three-week carboplatin, there is no benefit to intraperitoneal chemotherapy. So if people use intraperitoneal chemotherapy today, and it's only a small subset, they latch on to the old data and don't really, in my humble opinion, don't really understand that the control arm in those prior studies was wrong.
Getting back to neoadjuvant therapy, what regimen do you typically utilize? And then in the patients who then do go to surgery, how do you approach post-op treatment?
Right. So there are three options for that chemotherapy neoadjuvant patient. Many people continue to use every 3 week carboplatin and paclitaxel, an AUC of 5 or 6, paclitaxel 175 milligrams per square meter over 3 hours. That's still common. I think, though, the more common regimen is to take the paclitaxel and divide it into a weekly 80 milligrams per square meter. 80 times 3 is 240. That's more than the 175, so it's dose dense. So the most common is every 3 week carboplatin and dose dense paclitaxel. It would be acceptable to use bevacizumab as well with the every 3 week regimen. Some people do that, but if you do that, you shouldn't give it the cycle before surgery and the cycle after. So the most current regimen is dose dense weekly. The second would be every 3 week. There are some people that would add bevacizumab. You talked about the high volume disease where this is a potential benefit. But again, don't give it right before and right after the surgery.
Another issue that we talked about at the meeting that really has been fascinating to me over the years, and sort of sticking with the topic of ovarian cancer, is a new agent that's not approved right now, but from what I keep seeing, and Dr. Beerer again presented information on this, this is the antibody drug conjugate mirvetuximab. Can you talk a little bit about what your understanding about this agent is, how it works, what the efficacy tolerability is? I don't know if you maybe had patients on it.
Yeah, it's a very exciting agent. It's a, as you said, it's an antibody drug conjugate to the folate receptor. The folate receptor is overexpressed on ovarian cancer cells, for the most part not present on normal cells, and the same company that made TDM1 has now made a sort of similar antibody drug conjugate to this folate receptor. It's active particularly in second and third line. We have open at our site, and it's really around the world, a randomized phase 3 trial of doing it versus physician's choice chemotherapy. I'm excited about it. There was some initial concerns about eye toxicity, but with some steroid drops and some tweaking of the doses, that really is not a problem to any degree. So I think this is one of the most exciting agents in development right now.
Sorry, did you say you've had patients on it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Have you had any patients that had responses that you thought were clinically meaningful?
It's too early to tell. I haven't had one yet. It's too early. We're just getting started.
And the ophthalmologic issue, what's your view on that? It's what, like a keratitis or what is?
Yeah, it's a class effect. And with steroid drops, really doesn't seem to be a problem. It's scary because our vision is so important, but it's mild. And I always emphasize that it's completely reversible.
Any thoughts about whether you think this is going to come into practice? I mean, based on what you've read and seen, is it something you would like to use or do we need more data?
Yeah, so I always say this. I say we're at dusk in the angiogenesis world. It's the middle of the day for PARPs. it's the morning of immunotherapy, and antibody drug conjugates are tomorrow.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, you know, T-DM1 that you were talking about in breast cancer, brentuximab vedotin in lymphomas, particularly Hodgkin lymphoma, they are happening now. They're benefiting patients. But I guess when I first heard about these things, I thought they're going to be a lot more.
Yeah, so in ovarian cancer I'm talking about. So,
oh, yeah, sure, absolutely.
So, yeah, just in ovarian cancer. We're coming to the end of angiogenesis. We're in PARP now, but immunotherapy is coming. We just don't have a lot of data on antibody-drug conjugates. There's another one made by Bayer against mesothelin. So there are some rational tumor antigens, and we'll get there. Like you said, the paradigm is here. The technology is developed. I just think that we need the data to mature.
Let's move on now and just talk a little bit about endometrial cancer beyond what we were talking about with checkpoint inhibitors, as well as cervical cancer. And Angela's Accord covered that in the meeting. And one of the issues that she talked about in both of these tumors was what you were talking about before, bevacizumab. So there are data out there in endometrial cancer. She went through them. And of course, it's approved in cervical cancer. Can you talk today about your view of how, if at all, you see bevacizumab being integrated into the management of these two cancers?
Yeah, thank you for that. Let's start with endometrial cancer. So yesterday, I saw two patients with second-line recurrent endometrial cancer. We understand that the front line is, you know, carboplatin paclitaxel. And one patient was a patient that I admitted for my partner who was on single-agent doxorubicin. She had a malignant bowel obstruction, and I'm going to go around after this and send her to hospice. The other patient was a patient that was on pegylated liposomal doxorubicin and bevacizumab and had stable disease. I get it, it's one patient versus one patient, but that was my experience yesterday, that in the patient that with bevacizumab we were able to maintain tumor control, and with doxorubicin as a single agent or even single agent PLD, not very active. So I'm a fan of it. There's a reimbursement issue, and we were able to get it paid for in the patient that I saw in the clinic that has stable disease after six cycles, and she has a good quality of life.
In your mind, what are the global clinical numbers if one of your fellows comes up and says, in terms of what you see bevacizumab adding to chemotherapy in endometrial cancer, kind of globally, how do you see it affecting, let's say, PFS and overall survival?
Yeah, so I don't have any survival data. You know, the PFS is probably not quite as good as ovarian, which is, you know, 3 to 4 months. It's probably only a 3-month benefit. Yeah. But there are extreme responders to bevacizumab. And you already said it, we need a biomarker. And, you know, we've all seen these extreme responders. And the patient that I told you about is an extreme responder. So you can't just look at the median. And you said this with the immunotherapy, it's really about the tail. There will be some extreme responders in endometrial cancer where bevacizumab is a game changer.
So when you say extreme responders, are you kind of referring more to the chemo plus Bev with Bev maintenance kind of platform or a single agent platform?
No, a combination. Yeah.
Aren't there people also who benefit from Bev monotherapy, like you hear about people with ascites, et cetera?
Yes, mostly ovarian cancer, but yes.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I was talking about there in terms of extreme. So you think they're extreme responders, though, in endometrial?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow, that's interesting. How about cervical cancer? Of course, we've had the approval of Bev now for a little bit. How's it actually playing out in your practice?
We did a randomized phase 3 trial in the gynecologic oncology group. There's a 4-month improvement in overall survival when bevacizumab is added to chemotherapy, again, commonly platinum taxane-based chemotherapy. I think it's the global standard. When we survey our colleagues around the world, you know, newly diagnosed advanced disease or recurrent disease, they get, you know, chemotherapy Bev. We had a new chemotherapy start yesterday. I was in the clinic again. An unfortunate woman who we thought was cured had chemotherapy and radiation for a stage 2B cancer. She had about a 70 to 80% cure rate, and she had a 3-month PET scan, and she has, you know, widely metastatic disease. So we're going to give her chemotherapy and Bev, and we'll see what happens.
Any observations or thoughts in terms of complications specifically in cervical cancer for people receiving Bev? Particularly local pelvic complications, fistulae, et cetera, relation to radiation therapy.
So there is a very small, what we call GI perforation rate in ovarian, but what happens in cervical is a vaginal fistula rate. It's not the same thing. When you get a GI perforation in ovarian cancer, you get a blown out appendix, a ruptured diverticular abscess, a duodenal ulcer that ruptures. But a fistula between the rectum and the vagina can happen almost at 9% of cervical cancer patients. So the GI perforation in ovarian is frequently lethal. It's a terrible thing in cervical cancer, but it's not lethal. But it's much more common in cervical cancer, these vaginal fistulas. And it needs to be carefully considered as a risk and weighed against the 4-month improvement in overall survival. And I think you just mentioned that those patients that do get fistulas in cervical cancer, all of them, to our knowledge, have had prior pelvic radiation. But again, the risk is still relatively, I guess, low, 9%.
Anything else going on in either endometrial or cervical cancer in terms of new agents, new strategies that you want to comment on?
So there's a lot of interest in this listeria-based immunotherapy. We can use this bacterium as a vector to carry HPV antigens. There's a late-breaking abstract presented at the SGO showing that phase two, that this agent's probably active. And so there's a randomized phase three trial called Aim to Serve, where this agent is used as maintenance after frontline chemotherapy and radiation in very high-risk patients. And we're excited about that. That's a global trial. And in fact, that's the only phase three trial right now of immunotherapy in cervical cancer.
So, you know, I always kind of joke at meetings that I never understand, you know, pathways and biology. And actually, I was thinking that it kind of reminds me of when I do math with my 11-year-old son, you know, he gives me this sort of blank look, you know. So why don't you take a shot at explaining how the Listeria thing actually works?
So Listeria is a gram-positive bacterium. It's scalable, and it elicits a very, very robust immune response. And so you can develop plasmids and attenuate the bacteria. And this attenuated Listeria bacteria, which is loaded with HPV antigens, can be infused intravenously. Now, you might imagine infusing bacteria intravenously might cause some chills and some hypotension. So, you know, we give them some fluids and some Tylenol and monitor them carefully. And then 72 hours, even though it's attenuated, it's really not a pathogen now, we chase them with some antibiotics just in case. And we've seen some changes in the tumor immune microenvironment as kind of a window of opportunity study. We've seen a complete response in two patients in the phase two experience. So we're trying to do a phase three trial now in maintenance after completing chemotherapy and radiation called Aim to Serve.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special highlights program of a satellite CME symposium on the management of ovarian cancer.